Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History, our latest bonus episode. Tom, last week we did two episodes on the real Harry Potter, as we called it, or the history of British public schools. We did our live stream, which was about public school stories more generally.
A lot of public schools, Dominic.
A lot of public schools, but not too many, Tom. Never too many. This week we had a total change of tone, because we have your episode, your wonderful episode about the Colosseum.
Rome's arena of death. And Dominic, I know that we promised that we wouldn't just go on about things that we know about on this episode. There's been complaint, hasn't there, from some of the wangs that we just talk about the things that we know about. So therefore, we're going to try and make an effort to talk about things we know nothing about, with no doubt disastrous consequences. But just on the topic of Rome, have you been au fait with this exciting trend on TikTok where women keep asking men how often they think about the Roman Empire?
I've heard rumors of it, but I'm not really massively familiar with it because I'm not on TikTok.
Maybe it was on Twitter as well. Anyway, it's been all over the media in America that a woman was startled to ask her husband, how many times did you think about the Roman Empire? And he said, oh, at least four times a day.
Cracky.
And she said, what, really? And she put this out, and social media is buckling under the weight of American men saying, yeah, that's all I do is think about the Roman Empire.
I don't think about the Roman Empire as much as that, I'll be frank with you. I think about the IMF crisis of 1976. I think about the presidency of James Callaghan. Presidency, prime ministership.
The presidency of James Callaghan, do you? Oh,
well. It's president in my mind, Tom. President of my heart. I don't think about the Roman Empire. Do you think about the Roman Empire four times a day?
Oh, at least.
Yeah, but I mean, it's your job. It'd be weird if you didn't.
I know. So I was quite surprised how many people whose job it isn't to think about the Roman Empire seem to be thinking about the Roman Empire. I mean, it's kind of interesting because probably in Britain, the thing that most men would be thinking about, I would have thought, would be the Second World War.
Battle of Britain,
yeah. Perhaps.
Yeah.
But I think quite a lot of people seem to be thinking about the Roman Empire here as well. I'm just wondering in America whether it's because, you know, senates and capitals and founding fathers or whatever.
Maybe. Or maybe that's that kind of, the sort of Dan Carlin audience kind of, there's lots of Americans who spend their time thinking, you know, would a samurai beat a shark in a fight? or something like that, aren't they? I mean, there are like CEOs who think, and what are the 10 business lessons I can learn from the outcome of said fight?
Maybe, but there's been a slew of kind of learned essays in, you know, the TLS and the Literary Review or whatever, going on about Horace and Virgil. Right. And so this is what's prompting people to think about the Roman Empire. But this, what prompted me to get onto this riff is the Colosseum. I think the Colosseum embodies a huge part of why people do think about the Roman Empire. It gives a license for people to ponder ritualized violence.
Yeah. Because isn't there an argument, Tom, that people think about the Roman Empire because they like thinking about sex and violence?
I think there's absolutely a case for that. I mean, we've just been doing, we're midway through an absolutely epic series of episodes on the fall of the Empire of the Aztecs. And part of the fascination of the Aztecs is also that there are incredible staged spectacles of violence that to our way of thinking are unacceptable. And I do think that the Romans are, I mean, they're glamorous because they're cruel.
Yeah, of course they are.
But they're say, you know, it's the statute of limitations again. They're safely distant.
Agreed.
But clearly people are fascinated by the Nazis. I mean, people dress up as the SS and all kinds of things.
I agree completely. So we're doing the Aztec episodes right now. We've been recording some of them this morning. And people who enjoy commercial cash-ins will be delighted to hear that this is motivated by the fact the latest Adventures in Time is coming out this autumn on the fall of the Aztecs. And in that, one of the early chapters is called The Temple of Terror. And it's all about human sacrifice. And we had a great discussion at Penguin about, you know, how much you could do this for children.
Oh, they love it.
And I said, I think you are deluding yourselves if you don't think that children, this is the one thing they will lap up. And actually having done talks and things at schools, we've talked about this before in other contexts, there is this extraordinary fascination with the extremes of kind of violence for children. And of course, when it's done for children, it's slightly sanitized, it's at so many removes because it's so distant in time, the children think it's hilarious. So the TV series Horrible Histories used to revel in this. I don't know how much it does now. They did a wonderful song it was like a cover version of Staying Alive by the Bee Gees called Ain't Staying Alive, where there were Aztec priests singing about their ritual sacrifices. And kids loved it.
So they did. It was the Angry Aztecs, wasn't it? Was the
Angry
Horrible
Aztecs.
Histories book.
Yeah.
Was it Matthew Restall or some? I mean, it was...
He talks about it in his book. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so it is Matthew Restall, who's a brilliant, brilliant historian you know, thrillingly revisionist historian of the conquest of Mexico and the Aztecs and all that malarkey, but very hostile to the presentation of the Aztecs as kind of doing anything really that's to be condemned. And is very hostile to the role that they play in the horrible histories.
But do you want kids to be interested in the Aztecs or don't you?
Well, that's the question.
I remember having this conversation with Penguin. I said, you know, I could fill the book with interesting textiles, drainage patterns, but no sane child is going to read it. What they want is severed heads.
But equally, Dominic, I mean, you are very much on top of all the revisionist historiography, and you know that there are all kinds of issues around the question of sacrifice, and it's not just woke tosh. You know, there are serious questions to be answered about how fundamentally it actually was to Aztec society and all that kind of stuff.
But it definitely happened. Camilla Townsend came on our podcast and said it absolutely happened.
But I was just, the reason that I was kind of drawing it out is that people are sensitive about that in the way that they're not about gladiatorial combat. Nobody feels that to kind of revel in the spectacles of death that you get in the Colosseum is somehow
exoticizing and orientalizing the Romans.
Exactly, exoticizing the Romans because they're already exotic. Whereas there's obviously an incredible political sensitivity around doing that to the Aztecs because the descendants of the Aztecs are, relatively speaking, so oppressed by both in, you know, contemporary politics in Mexico, but also by the weight of the kind of historical contempt that their descendants have labored under.
Although I'm not sure how true that last point is, because I think
that's how it's framed, though, isn't it?
It is framed that way, but I don't believe.
And
that
also, the Aztecs stand in for indigenous people across the world.
Yeah, they do. Tom Theo says, "Enough talking about the Aztecs. We've got 8 episodes coming. Well, we have at least 6 episodes coming.
We have. So we should do a question, shouldn't we?
We should do. So we have loads of questions. I am very conscious, by the way, as Tom is, that there have been a few people on the Discord saying, can you have a greater range of questioners and questions? We will try our best.
So Matt Hefner.
Go on, Matt Hefner.
Has Matt Hefner been on before?
I've never heard that name. I'm delighted to welcome him.
What single place on planet Earth has seen the most human death cumulatively over the course of recorded history? I mean, this is, I'd have to think about that. So why don't you go with that first, Dominic?
So my answer to that, which is probably wrong, but the first thing that jumps into my head is there's a historian called Timothy Snyder who has a book called Bloodlands, and it's a book about 20th century history. It is a book specifically about Western Ukraine, Belarus, what is now Eastern Poland. And he says this is the epicenter of the 20th century horror story. So if you lived in Belarus, if you were born in 1900, you would probably see more extremes of suffering, more horrific regimes, more of the very worst that human nature has to offer than in any other corner of the world. Because, you know, it's got Stalin, Hitler, Stalin again, endless pogroms, the genocides, all this stuff. So that's, he points to this, but he says this is a peculiarly blood-soaked corner of kind of Eurasia. So there's that. I mean, the only other thing I'd say though, Tom, China, I mean, there is so much enormous
millions of people
suffering in China that is so little known in the West.
So whenever we do an episode with Rana Mitter and, you know, he'll be talking about the Second World War or the Communist Revolution or what happens under Mao, and you'll be reading a book in preparation for talking to him. And there'll be a paragraph and it'll kind of say another 3 million people died in the little known Yellow River famine of 1943 or something. And you just feel overwhelmed by the sheer number of people who seem to have died in China in the 20th century. And I think that everything to do with superlatives, ultimately you end up in China because the numbers of people who live there and therefore are subject to the kind of the forces that result in mass casualties are so much greater. So I would guess China, but there would be another way of framing the question, which is cumulatively. I mean, are those total numbers of deaths, or are we talking over the period of over the course of recorded history?
Yeah.
In which case, I would say maybe Palestine. It's a, you know, Jericho, that kind of area. It's been a center of human civilization for thousands and thousands of years, long before the rise of civilization in Mesopotamia. Jericho was a kind of proto city. And because of its strategic situation as the kind of the pivot between the two great centers of ancient civilization, Egypt and Mesopotamia, armies are endlessly going back and forth through it and fighting each other, conquering and slaughtering people in their path. And that strategic hinge means that it's been a place of warfare right the way up into the present day. So I don't think that the number of people who've died in Palestine cumulatively would compare with the total number of people who've died in China or Ukraine, Belarus, you know, those, the bloodlands, just in the 20th century. But I would say cumulatively in terms of over the course of the millennia, probably that would be a good, I mean, it's the most strategically neuralgic place in the world, I'd have thought, followed possibly by Belgium.
Belgium. But is your argument there that more people have lived there?
Well, I was whether cumulatively is referring to the total numbers of deaths or cumulatively to the number of years.
Because the interesting thing is,
so have people been fighting each other in a particular place, a particular corner? Because China or, you know, Eastern Europe, that's a massive place. You've got to say, if you want to kind of move down, is there a particular place in China that's where people
but
have
my sense is, and this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that Matt is really asking about violent deaths, isn't he? He's not asking about people dying peacefully in their beds. He hasn't said that explicitly.
Deaths. I'm talking about people dying in wars and things.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, talking people dying in wars and violence generally, Eduardo Vargas, who I believe is another first-time questioner, has a good question. Tom, this is really one for you. Who was considered the most evil person in history before Hitler came along?
I think that it is Hitler who made that question of who the most evil person in history was one that people keep asking. I don't think people really ask that question beforehand, because I think the standards of the embodiment of evil was much more theological. So we know who Dante thought the most evil people were. He thought that it was Brutus and Cassius and Judas. So you have Satan in the very depths of the Inferno, three mouths, and he's munching on one of those three because they are the betrayers of Christ and of Caesar. I mean, I don't think many people today would say that Brutus and Cassius were the most evil, nor even Judas.
No.
But I think that the idea that there has to be an embodiment of evil, that somehow we can't have a notion of what is good without a notion of what is evil, that's a legacy of Christianity in the West. And part of what happens with the Nazis in the aftermath of the Second World War is that, and we've talked about this before, the Nazis constitute a mythology that replaces the Christian mythology. So Hitler takes the place of the devil.
I agree with you, Tom. I was just thinking about the question, who would I say? And I was struggling to think of somebody.
Because people human beings don't embody, you know, even in the 19th century, the West is still a very Christian society. The embodiment of evil is obviously Satan, is the devil. It's a theological concept, and it's not just, you know, it's in Zoroastrianism and all kinds of things.
Isn't it interesting that, in the Napoleonic Wars, or the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, people never in Britain wrote that Napoleon was evil. They might say he was a bad man, and they might say he had to be beaten and whatever. They'd say that of Robespierre or any other of Britain's opponents. It would have seemed ludicrously extreme and simplistic to say he was the embodiment of evil, wouldn't it?
But in a Christian world, human beings can't be perfect, but equally they can't be supremely evil. We are midway between supernatural forces that are the embodiments of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that changes in the 20th century. And the Nazis absorb that kind of cultural need to identify with someone or some force as being evil.
But it would be weird now, wouldn't it, to stand up in public and say, I don't think Hitler was evil. I don't think he was the embodiment of evil. People would be very troubled if you did that. They would regard you as very suspect.
But Sir Ian Kershaw, when he came on and did the two episodes, I can't believe we did only two episodes on the life of Hitler.
Yeah.
But he came on and we asked exactly that question. Was Hitler evil? And he refused to answer it. He said that's not part of what a historian has to deal with.
Yeah. Which was, the right answer, actually.
It is the right answer.
Yeah. His argument would be it's not helpful.
Because if you do start arguing Hitler is evil, then you're into the dimension of theology or philosophy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's our answer. Okay, FX. Question for both Dominic and Tom. Have they read Churchill's books on English history and what do they think of them? Was he any good as a historian? No, I haven't, is the answer to that. So I'm out of that. But Dominic, have you?
Yes. Yes, I have.
I rather hope you had.
I did a project at school when I was about 12 on the English Civil War. And I had a copy of Churchill's History of the English Speaking Peoples, which was in our prep school library. It will amaze people to know. And I loved it. I loved it. And actually, Churchill wrote, he might as well have written for kind of nerdy 12-year-olds, because that's basically the level of his prose. It's very sweeping, very grandiose.
Has he been a model for you in writing Adventures in Time?
No, because he My instinct is to try and to make it as relatively simple as possible. But I suppose there is something about Churchill. Churchill, here's a swashbuckling histories. He's always talking of the great captains of history and all that kind of thing. Yeah. And I think kids love that, actually. I think they love to feel that it's the Lord of the Rings.
So he said, he famously said of King Arthur, it is all true or it should be.
Yeah, that's a very good attitude for a historian.
Well, but is it a good, I mean, it's, in a way, it is a good attitude to have if you're writing books for children.
But probably not from academic monographs.
But I'm kind of wondering, over the course of the children's books that you've written, you will often come up with stories that you'd want to be true.
Yeah.
You know, Alfred burning the cakes or...
You put them in. Of course you put them in. Put them in and then maybe a little footnote. This probably didn't happen. But I mean, Tom, that happens without... I've asked you this question before about your own books.
Yeah.
With Rubicon or Persian Fire. The great kind of swashbuckling narratives that you write. You know, the sources are partial and we have to wrestle with them to kind of make sense of them and put them into context and stuff. But if you want to write a narrative that people read, sometimes you have to say...
It was said that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Men yeah. said later that...
Yeah, I don't think I would say that King Arthur was real, though. I don't think it... I cannot imagine any book in which I would ever say that.
Yeah.
No matter how much I wanted it to sell. Anyways, but was he any good as a historian?
Not as an academic historian, but as a good historical storyteller, Churchill. He was a good writer. Now, of course, his histories of the Second World War were not written by him. He had a great team of historians working for him. He made an enormous amount of money from his history books, by the way. I mean, colossal amounts of money in the 1920s and 1930s for his books about Marlborough.
An inspiration to us all.
Yeah, a great inspiration. Tom, question from James. Which of Shakespeare's plays has had the greatest cultural impact?
This is James Watt.
Yeah.
That's a very good question. I mean, I think the play that embodies Shakespeare is really Hamlet.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's, I mean, a huge influence on...
But is it one of those things that's an influence on other writers more than on the public?
Yeah. But I would say, I mean, it wouldn't be one play, but it would be a compendium of plays. I would say it's the history plays, because I think that they have given England what I can't really think any other country has, which is a popular account of its, a crucial part of its history that has become part of its culture.
Yeah.
I mean, along, you know, it's so it's Richard II right the way up to Richard III. So it's 100 years of history.
So they've profoundly affected England's sense of its own history, its own identity.
They've also had a profound effect on the, on how countries that have been settled by people from England see history, I would say. Would you agree with that?
Hamlet is the one that's had the most influence, I would say, on writers and artists and so on, because it's regarded as the most interesting, the most complicated, the one with the deepest insight into human nature.
Yeah, I think so.
But on the public at large, probably people's favourite play that they've all heard of is Romeo and Juliet, do you think?
Or Midsummer Night's Dream.
I think the comedies, I think there are an awful lot of people who hate the comedies. They thought them as unfunny.
Midsummer Night's Dream, people do love Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, I think all Shakespeare is brilliant, actually.
One last question, MB1872, or maybe 1872. The US is having issues with gerontocratic politicians refusing to retire at the moment, and the USSR had the same problem in the Brezhnev era. Can any parallels be drawn between them, or is this the same symptom with two unrelated causes? Just to broaden that out, societies in which old age is seen as a good thing as opposed to a bad thing for in political leaders?
That is a good question. So in the United States, it is an extraordinary position that this politics has got itself into. Wasn't the case. You know, I think back to 1992 when Bill Clinton and Al Gore were the Democratic ticket, and they were both, you know, seen as kids of the 60s, a new generation. George W. Bush wasn't that old when he won the presidency in 2000. Obama? I mean, Obama had only been in the Senate for 2 years. But they seem to be in a right mess now. Nancy Pelosi, the guy who's the Republican, Mitch McConnell. I mean, how old is he?
The one who keeps kind of freezing.
He has to be kind of turned off.
And he suddenly gets freezing. They have to turn him off and start him up again.
Exactly. That's an extraordinary thing. I wonder whether, our American listeners will have their own views. I would be worried whether the structure of campaign finance makes that more likely, because you need so much money to succeed. You need so many donations. You need so many contacts.
You need time to build up.
You have to have built up both a war chest and a network of supporters. And as a young politician, it's much harder to do that. They also, the US Senate and the Congress generally, they've always had this sort of deep kind of institutional, this hierarchical system where you get to be the chairman of a committee and all this kind of thing, but based on your years of service. And they really reward longevity. I mean, there were lots of very, very old politicians in the sort of 60s and 70s when the southern states were basically controlled by a kind of what was then a democratic, gerontocratic elite. And eventually then a lot of them became Republicans later on. I would be worried about that.
I mean, that's true of Biden, isn't it? Trump is sui generis.
Yeah, but Biden, I mean, you can be Biden's greatest admirer and still think he's about 50 years too old to be president. But
So Trump makes great play of the fact that he is youthful, he goes out and plays golf, and he's tremendously energetic and things. But I mean, his recent pronouncements have been all over the place. Did you see the recent one where he said, Biden wants to take us into World War II?
I mean, I just think it's bonkers that their next election will be between two people who are so old.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't get an elderly relative to do that job, would you? I mean, you'd be like torturing them, be mad.
So I'm doing a whole load of talks at the moment on publicising PACs.
Yeah.
And I'm basically structuring it around how the various emperors presented themselves, so looking at their hairstyles and things like that.
Oh, yes.
But one of the things that is the degree to which they make play with the tradition of how Augustus presented himself, which was always youthful. So Augustus, even though he, you know, lived decades and decades, he always presented himself looking like Apollo. And the older Republican tradition where you present yourself as looking as old as possible, because a senator, I mean, literally means an old man. To be in the Senate is tremendous. You know, you've got to be old.
It's really
like the Garousia in Sparta. It literally means an assembly of old men. And so you have all these kind of portrait busts in the Republic where bags under the eyes, crow's feet, wrinkles,
really?
Bald, kind of lowering. And both these traditions are kind of part of the palette with which emperors choose to present themselves. So definitely tradition in antiquity that old age is, you know, can be seen as something very positive because they always have a kind of respect. Youth is seen as something dangerous, which I think is probably truer than the idea that the old age is something dangerous, I would think.
The youth is dynamism.
Particularly in monarchies or republics, that they can lead you astray. That youth is something that has to be reined in. You have to kind of learn not to just kind of rush off charging at people and so on.
Yeah,
I think that's
right. I mean, I think the Brezhnev era, the extraordinary thing, I always find this amusing, that accounts of Soviet politics in the 1980s will always say of Mikhail Gorbachev, such a young man, a thrusting reformer and stuff. And you kind of look at photos of Gorbachev, you think, really? I mean, but of course, that's because the people who he's surrounded with are kind of in their, they're 2 centuries old. And that was an ossified system that meant that people got stuck in place and they couldn't be challenged. I would be worried if I was American that their politics is in danger of becoming ossified in the same way. Anyway, we are in the middle of this epic series about the Aztecs. We've actually been talking for, just looking at the time, we've been talking for almost 6 hours.
5 hours, yeah.
So we still are nowhere near finishing. So we can't spend as much time on these questions as we would love to.
So if we've sounded like our brains are a little bit flat, that's because they are.
So I'm just going to tell people what they have to look forward to. So actually, what you have to look forward to at the end of this week are 2 episodes that will be coming out to you on Thursday morning, and they are on Chile. They are on the Allende presidency and the coup masterminded, or was it, by General Pinochet.
Pinochet, isn't it, we decided.
Pinochet, yeah. And they will be followed on Monday by 4 episodes on the history, the strange history of British fascism. And even if you're not interested in British fascism, those take in everything from the society and culture of the 1920s to Tom's own obsession.
The fascist boxing coach who turns out to be a man.
Yes. Well, hold on. When you say turns out to be a man.
Sorry, the other way around, isn't it? The fascist boxing coach who turns out to be a woman. Sorry. So Oswald Mosley, Cable Street.
Yeah.
A brilliant impression by me of Jeremy Corbyn, the erstwhile leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah, you do a very good Thank impression. You.
And then by miles the best episode, which is all about the Mitfords and Hitler.
I can't believe you got that in. Someone insisted on doing an extra episode when Theo and I wanted to go home about
Unity
about
Mitford,
Mitford family
and Diana Moseley.
And absolutely terrifyingly for our listeners, I should say, you also will have on your feed, on your podcast feed tomorrow, you can really look forward to this.
No, it'll be yesterday because they'll be listening
you've
to
had
Wednesday.
It.
So they'll have
but
had
they've
it.
Probably they've probably skipped it, Tom. They've got an excerpt from Tom's book, which you've probably never heard about because he's never advertised it. It is called Pax, isn't it, Tom? And it's all
it
about
is,
the Romans.
And it's out in America next week. So that's
so you've
why.
Got an excerpt from that. Are you reading it yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. So, Tom, you and I were doing the audio book for The Rest is History last week.
Yeah, we were. And, yes. Have we not talked about that?
God almighty. I mean, I genuinely questioned my role on this planet at various points when I was recording that audiobook, when I was having to
it's
record.
It's fun, though. It's
I was
fun.
Recording a whole chapter in the voice of Adrian Childs.
yes, I did it, yes. So there's quite a lot of kind of sports presenting. But I think my favourite bit was doing the Empress Theodora as a Love Island contestant.
Yeah, I thought that was... there's a bit where I was looking at the script and it was Tom, as Stanley Baldwin says, it is what it is, babes, or something like that. That gives people a terrifying glimpse of how that book will turn out. Anyway, so listen, we're going to go back and continue with the Aztecs. You have British fascism and Chile to come, and you have Pax. So you have loads of stuff, and we'll be answering loads more bonus questions next time, hopefully more than we've managed today. So please, please, please keep them coming, as diverse, as weird, as wonderful as possible. And thank you, as always, for subscribing. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.